was in Thailand, so someone gave me a new book, which had just come out, and it was on EQ, emotional quantum, or emotional intelligence, and it had become a bestseller, and reading that book, it was interesting, but it wasn't very new from my point of view. And for those who are not familiar with the term EQ, it is that they have noticed, for example, in business, that you can have a person who is intellectually brilliant, has the highest degrees, the highest qualifications for a job, but when they're taken on and placed in that position, they lack the moral fiber or lack emotional intelligence. That was the term used. They found that maybe they weren't skilled at getting on with co-workers. They tended to be very reactionary, or they weren't honest, or they couldn't be on time, or they couldn't take responsibility, or they were lazy. And many of these conditions have come into this term EQ, to be emotionally stable, to be emotionally intelligent, to be emotionally developed. And the author was writing that in many ways, these conditions, these factors of emotional intelligence or emotional development, emotional maturity, are more important in the world, more important in business, and more important in life than IQ, having a high knowledge, having a sharp intelligence and sharp wit, having abilities. And he was arguing that if you have a person who is intelligent but is not emotionally stable, emotionally secure, then often that leads to great problems in the business world. This book was written with a business slant. And the argument was that it's much better to have someone who's maybe not so intelligent, but has integrity, is honest, is reliable, is someone who gets on well with others, is a pleasant co-worker and knows how to deal with other people, is patient, who is committed, who is dedicated, has a stability and a determination in what they do. It's often many of these factors that an employee, an employer wants in an employee, and it's these qualities which lead to strength of character. And when I was reading this book, I thought, well, it's very good that someone is switching on to something that has been a standard teaching in Buddhism for many thousands of years, and that is the qualities of what we call the barometers, the 10 barometers. And in these 10 barometers, the Buddha talked about the 10 qualities which are, and barometers is a very hard word to translate, but it's like spiritual qualities, or you can say spiritual maturity, which when developed, when cultivated, grow. And when they grow, they will blossom and produce fruit. And these barometers are talked about as the 10 qualities that the Bodhisattva, the yet-to-be-enlightened Buddha, developed in his many past lives. That in his many past lives, he had made a determination that in the future he would become a fully enlightened Buddha. But to do that, he had to develop certain qualities. He had to develop generosity of mind, and openness and kindness, to want to serve and give and share with others. He had to develop profound virtue, to stand in honesty and integrity, to be harmless, to not hurt any living being, and to not take anything from any other living creature that is not given to him, to not hurt with any sexual conduct, to not lie or deceive or use harsh speech or frivolous speech or gossip, which is going to cause pain and injury to others, to cause dissension and the separation of those who's in harmony. And he had to develop in each lifetime his quality of not only generosity, not only virtue, but also the sense of renunciation, giving things up, abandoning things, seeing whatever was causing him a fault. If he wanted to change, he had to give up those unskillful behaviors and develop skillful behaviors. And that's what we do in our spiritual development. We have to change. If we want to stay the same, we won't progress in the spiritual path. We have to see what is unskillful and determine to change that. And that takes effort. That takes commitment. And nekakamma is this quality of abandoning. And I'll go into this in more detail later on. He also had to develop wisdom, profound wisdom, an understanding of the causes for dissatisfaction. Why was he unhappy? Why, when he didn't get what he wanted, did he suffer? So if he was going to become fully enlightened, he had to be very wise. And to be very wise, he had to turn inward onto the cause of his own problems. Why was he suffering? Why was he discontent? Why was he born? Why would he die? He had to analyze, reflect, contemplate these profound questions, to give attention to them, not to ignore them. And he also had to develop energy, the aspiration. If you're going to seek supreme enlightenment, there has to be dedication, effort, energy, application, striving to obtain what is unobtained, to reach out and strive for that which is higher, more supreme. And he also had to develop in that a lot of patience. Each lifetime, we're presented with problems and difficulties. And there's the need for great patience, great endurance, great perseverance, to shake off the difficulties and problems in life and to strive on, to go forth, to continue on one's commitment to this goal, this path, this aspiration that we have of obtaining ultimate peace, ultimate liberation. And also there had to be a commitment to truth, what we call satya. If we want to know what is true in the world, we have to have a sincerity to truth. We have to have a sense of integrity. What is true, that is what we seek out. And then we reject what is false, what is not true, what is not real, what is an illusion, what is deception. To find gold, we have to dig up a lot of earth and filter out what is not gold first, what is not pure gold. It takes a process of filtering out, removing everything which is not the real thing, and until we are left with pure gold. So there's dedication to truth, to honesty, to integrity, to ultimate reality, is another quality that the Bodhisattva, the unenlightened Buddha, the unenlightened striver, Gautama, had to do in each lifetime before he became the Buddha. And this dedication, determination to satya, truth, is very important. And then he also had to have this adhitana, what's called adhitana, which adhitana means this, to make a determination and then stick to it, to make a goal and stick to it, to make a determination. In this case, the Buddha made a determination to become enlightened. And whatever difficulty, whatever problem, whatever circumstances he had in his life, he always remembered, that's my goal, that's my aspiration. And for all of us, if we want to seek some spiritual path, some happiness, some peace, we have to make a clear goal, a clear aspiration, and be determined to stick to that, that continuing on, regardless of what comes up. And also, the other quality, the other barometer that the Buddha had to develop was great loving kindness. Wishing for the benefit and welfare and happiness of every being in the world and in the universe. And in Buddhism, that doesn't just mean human beings, but all beings. Both animal, bird, insect, beings that are seen, beings that are not seen. Those here, those far away, the big, the small, the great, the mighty, or the insignificant. There's this universal care, this undiscerning compassion and kindness, and wishing for their benefit and happiness. And also, the other barometer that the Bodhisattva had to develop was equanimity. That is, when life's difficulties and problems occurred, and to have a balanced state of mind, to not get distracted or disappointed with difficulties and problems, but to remain balanced, centered, equanimous. When good things happen, to not get too excited, not get too elated. And when the difficulties and problems arise, to not get discouraged, to not get negative, to fall into depression, but to be balanced and be centered. And these are the qualities which I was reading about in this book on EQ that was recommended as the good qualities to develop, and even more important qualities than IQ. And I realize that these qualities are actually what the Buddha called barometers. If we have these qualities of equanimity, patience, endurance, honesty, virtue, generosity, kindness, truthfulness, dedication, commitment, and these extreme qualities, they mature the mind. And these qualities are called the barometers, the 10 barometers. It means these 10 spiritual qualities which lead to spiritual maturity, lead to spiritual growth. And they are the qualities that a person needs to develop if they are to become a Buddha, a fully enlightened one. And the Buddha cultivate these to their limit and then obtained supreme enlightenment. So this evening I wanted to talk about these 10 qualities, but to do so I thought that because of time limit, it would be useful to break them up into two groups of 5. And I'll speak tonight about the first 5 of these barometers, these spiritual qualities, and how we can develop these qualities so that we develop this emotional maturity. The first of the spiritual qualities is dana, generosity. And for many of us who are Buddhists, we are very aware that this is a fundamental underlying quality in the Buddha's teachings, that if we want to obtain freedom and liberation, the first thing we have to free ourselves from is stinginess. Because stinginess arises from fear, from self-concern, from me, from mine, and concern for what's in it for me and mine, for protection of me and mine. Whereas generosity goes against that very tight, very self-centered state of mind. To do an act of kindness, we all know, don't we? That it means trusting, sharing, opening up. Liberality means to give happiness to others by sharing what we have. And actually, I remember Ajahn Chah once saying that he gave the example, if you have two apples and then you decide to share one of those apples with another person, but you decide to give them the smaller apple, then you haven't understood generosity. And we do it, don't we? We weigh up the apples and, well, I'll keep this one for myself, and here, you have that one. And we notice that we're all like that. The Buddha, before his enlightenment, was like that as well. But he knew that that was a stain. That wasn't pure generosity. The harder form of generosity is to give your friend or the other person the bigger apple, and you have the smaller one. It takes more self-sacrifice. It challenges fear of, I won't get enough, I'll go without. And it means the mind has to trust and leap forward. Oh, it's good to give, it's good to share. And this attitude of sharing is a foundation stone for overcoming selfishness, overcoming greed, self-concern and self-importance of wanting to have for oneself. And what we find is the more generous we are, then the more generous others are to us. It's quite profound that. That's why in this Buddhist community, in this Buddhist society, we never charge for the teachings of the Buddha. Because truth should be given with compassion. If it's universal truth, then it's there for everybody and should be shared with everybody. Because all beings are caught in this realm of samsara, this realm of suffering, this cycle of old age, sickness and death. And if we have real compassion for the beings caught in this cycle, then we'll do our utmost to help them, to assist if they want to be assisted. It doesn't mean pushing the teachings down their throat even if they're uninterested. It means, if you want to know, I'm happy to help in my small way. If I can give, if I can help, and I do that freely. And that's always been one of the things that really attracted me to the Buddha's teaching, that it was free. And that, to me, is one of the great acts of generosity of the Buddha. He never had a secret teaching which he just kept for the initiated disciples. The Buddha said, I do not teach with a closed fist. I teach with an open hand, that everything I have is there for all to see. I don't have some esoteric, mystical teaching. for the few, but it is there for whoever wants it, who's ever interested. And that's this quality of generosity. But generosity in Buddhism doesn't mean just charity. That's a very important part of it. But it has another aspect of it, which I want to talk about tonight, because you've heard many talks about the aspect of dana or generosity. But I want to give it another slant on it tonight. There's a very important aspect of generosity that Buddha talked about, which is he talked about doing acts of charity, giving and helping others, because that is meritorious and it brings us happiness and it brings other people happiness. It's for our own benefit and for their benefit. But he also talked about a form of generosity which is quite unique, and it's very Indian, and that is the idea of doing charity and service and supporting the spiritual path to enlightenment. And very often you hear in the Buddha's teachings him praising people, supporting both monastics and those other people seeking enlightenment. And the Buddha didn't actually, he wasn't exclusive. He actually praised people to support all religious seekers. If they have integrity and sincerity in that path, then to support them in their search for liberation and freedom. The Buddha praised that. And there was one time when a very wealthy lay disciple, it wasn't a lay disciple of his, but a very wealthy lay man, converted to Buddhism after hearing the Buddha's teachings. And this man was very wealthy, very famous, and he said, now that I have understood the Buddha's teachings, I take the Buddha as my refuge, and I want to support the Buddha and the monks. And the Buddha said to him, previously you had been a supporter of other ascetics. You should continue to support them. So the Buddha wasn't trying to say you should just support me or my group. He was saying that any support to the spiritual path, any service you can give to those who are seeking liberation is meritorious. And this is actually a very important factor. So, for example, just supporting people doing meditation, offering service and encouragement to people who are doing something good. Wherever that goodness is done, if we do that with the intention that we're willing to support those who are seeking truth, then that is an act of generosity, because what it does is gives the opportunity or the potential for truth to be discovered. And just like here, as well as many other religious centres, this place is run purely on volunteers and service. And all those people are doing and developing this barometer of acts of generosity and service, so that all of us can sit here and listen to a talk. We have these facilities, we have these things to use. That has come out of kindness and generosity. And that happens in many, many places, many environments, many institutions in the world, that people are giving. And that's a very important aspect of generosity. And generosity is very profound. Very, very profound. And one of the things that I've noticed as a monk is that it's not that when you become a monk you don't have opportunities to give. Maybe you don't have material things to give, but you have a lot that you can give as an example. You give of your time. You help people in need. You reach out to those who are suffering. This is all acts of generosity and kindness and giving. Just sharing a kind word with someone who's suffering is an act of generosity, an act of dana, and leads to emotional maturity in ourselves, leads to emotional growth. other paramita is sila paramita, and this is virtue. Virtue, we all know, very familiar with the five precepts. That is the foundation stone of a Buddhist. But also in Buddhism, there is the eight precepts, which the Buddha encouraged lay people to sometimes endeavor, sometimes to strive, to sometimes refine our virtue. And the five precepts, of course, is to develop harmlessness, to not kill any living being, to be a person who moves gently through the world, who's harmless, who doesn't disturb, doesn't destroy, doesn't cause pain. The next precept is, of course, honesty, to not take anything that's not given. And that's one of the beautiful things of living in a monastery. You know, if you can put something down here, and tomorrow it'll be in the same place. If it's not in the same place, someone has picked it up and put it aside for you. He's keeping it safely for you. You know you can trust the people you're sharing your life with. And honesty, not taking what is not given. It leads to honesty and trust. Not commit adultery. This is one of the precepts of the lay community. We see how much pain this one causes when trust is broken. When our sense of commitment to a person is destroyed because of unskillful behavior. And then right speech, to not to use speech which is drifting away from the truth. But we speak what is true and honest and skillful, what is kind and generous, which goes to the heart. And then to not take drugs and intoxicants. Just on that one, I was reading a statistic that they said that 70% of psychiatric problems are caused by drugs and intoxicants. They have that as their basis. And that's an important thing to reflect on at this time of year. How many unskillful things are said and done. How much heedlessness occurs under the influence of something that's supposed to bring us happiness. A large percentage of the people in jail are there because of drugs and intoxicants, of unskillful behavior which has occurred under that influence. It leads to heedlessness. And if we're looking for happiness, we can find happiness within ourselves, which is independent of those things. And therefore free of paranoia, free of guilt, free of anger, free of violence that arises from those influences. But then the Buddha said that for those lay people who at special times want to refine their spiritual practice, then they can undertake the eight precepts. For on special days, for example, tomorrow we're going to do an eight precept day, or on where one wants to become more spiritual by simplifying one's life. The first one of those eight precepts is we simplify eating. Because in our lay life, especially at this time of year, how much of our life is concerned with food? How much is time is taken up with these things? Thought and conversation is taken up with food. And so, keeping the eight precepts, we would stop eating in the afternoon. Just put that aside so that we can use that time for meditation, use that time for spiritual practice. And then the other of the eight precepts is not to to listen to music, to go to distractions, to adorn the body. The reason we're doing that, we only do this on certain occasions, you don't have to do it all the time, but the reason is that so we're focusing our mind on meditation time, on spiritual time. We're not trying to distract ourselves or get attached to the body. And then we develop a practice of sleeping little. Sleeping little means to be awake. Its opposite is to be awake. If we're seeking truth, then we have to be alert to truth and awake to truth. You may notice tonight I'm not having to hold up the microphone because I got sick of it falling over. And so I went to the monastery and made a new base for it. And the piece of jarrah wood that I used for the base is one of the monks' pillows. He kindly gave up his pillow. I don't know whether he wanted a softer one or a new one, but he kindly gave up his pillow so I could use his piece of jarrah for the base for the microphone. Because the monks, many of the monks at the monastery, use wooden pillows. Why? So as not to crash out too long. To be awake. Now, that may seem extreme, but when you're trying to seek alertness, brightness, and clarity, we're not trying to annihilate ourselves just in sleep. We rest enough. And so some of the monks will use a wooden pillow. Many of us don't even use mattresses. We sleep on the floor, on a piece of carpet. Why is that? So as we stay alert, stay bright, wake up. And this is a way of training to be bright and alert. And this is one of the things that we can develop in our spiritual practice to refine our sila, our virtue, develop it in the way that it inclines towards alertness, honesty, brightness, purity, integrity, and sincerity. The other quality that we're developing in these barometers is this nekakamma, which is this quality of giving up, this quality of renouncing. And that is actually a very important quality. Renouncing goes against greed, the desire to accumulate, the desire to hoard, seeking out more and more. And in our society, it's a consumerist society. It's based on consuming more and more. But actually, is that necessarily good? Do we need so much? And if we start to use less, especially in the developed world, then there's going to be more to share with others. And so learning to use what is necessary, but not what we want, or just what we want. I was very impressed. One day we had a young girl who came to our monastery, and I was speaking to her, and I said, we were talking about robes, and I said, the monks just have two or three robes. And I said, how many sets of clothes have you got? And she said, oh, lots. And then I said, how many toys you got? And she said, lots. And so I suggested to her maybe if she could go through the things she had and put some aside that she doesn't use in the last, or she hasn't used in the last year, and give those away to needy children, and any clothes that she's not using, to put those aside and give those away. And she did that, and she was very happy. And I was very impressed that she actually did that. Her father told me she did that just before Christmas because maybe she wants more toys, but I'm not so sure. But she certainly had a big smile on her face when she told me. I thought that was very impressive, and I just wondered if maybe everyone in this room, they went home and opened the wardrobe and sorted out what they haven't worn in the last year. Or they looked at all the things in their house which they haven't used and maybe shared those with somebody else. may bring a bit of joy to someone and also unburden us. This is this quality of giving up, renouncing, not taking what you don't need. And also this quality of giving up is also a mental quality, to give up unwholesome states and to take on wholesome states. I was living in a monastery in Thailand last year, or this year in June, and being in that monastery, being with Thai people, they saw a Western monk and they wanted to offer lots of bread, because they think that Western monks love bread and that we only live on bread and we can't eat rice, and so they went out of their way to buy all this expensive white bread. And I'm not particularly fussy about bread, but because these people had gone to great expense and great effort to bring this bread, which I normally wouldn't eat, but when they offered it to me, I was so touched just by their goodness and their kindness and their effort and energy that I would always take some and eat it, even though I didn't like it. And the reason was just that goodness should be encouraged in the world, and that kindness, that effort, they were trying to make me happy, so I should try to make them happy. And we had one other Western monk, an American, who was living in the monastery, and I noticed he would never take the bread. He'd always pass it down the line. And one day I asked him, "Why don't you take the bread?" And he said, "Oh, Venerable, I determined I'd never take the bread because it's my favorite food. I love bread. So I've determined not to take what I really like so I can go against greed, so I can overcome my desire for what I really like. And I've determined just to eat the food that I don't like that the lay people offer." And I thought that was interesting, because in the same monastery, had one person taking bread because he didn't like it, and then another person not taking bread because he liked it. So this is this quality of nekakamma, renouncing, giving up our likes and dislikes. But how often do we do that? Often it's very rare, isn't it? We tend to take what we want, do what we like. But it's this quality of sacrificing likes and dislikes for the overcoming, the abandoning of greed, hatred, and delusion. So we give up, share, abandon things. And so we can develop this quality of renouncing. Even emotional states, we can abandon those, renounce them and give up those states. I remember just recently someone commented, and I thought it was a very beautiful comment. They were talking about a person who was staying in the monastery. And they said, that person who is staying in the monastery is a person who doesn't give offense and doesn't take offense. I thought that was a very beautiful phrase. They're a person who doesn't offend others in their body and speech, but also they don't take offense of what others do to them or say to them. And I thought a combination of both those qualities is actually very rare in the world, in a person. It's very noble and worthy of aspiring to. Because sometimes we often are unwilling to abandon and give up those slights, those injuries, those painful words that someone said a long time ago, those sense of rejections, those negative things or painful things that happen to us. We never abandon them. We never shake them off. We never give them up. We cling and hang on to them and sometimes seek our own revenge, our own ways of getting back. But to be a person who doesn't take offense how others treat you and doesn't give offense to others, that's very noble, that's very rare. Something aspire to. And that's a quality we can do. We can look at those things that we're hanging on to and abandon them. Develop neka kamma, the sense of renouncing them. And as we renounce more and more, we become freer. Natan Shah used to say, the more you give up, the more you let go, the more freer you'll become. If you let go a little, then you have a little bit of peace. If you let go a lot, abandon a lot, then you have a lot of peace, a lot of freedom. And if you let go completely, then you'll be completely free. So learning to let go, to abandon greed, hatred, and delusion leads more and more to freedom. And so this neka kamma is very important. And that leads to the other two qualities of the paramitas, which is wisdom and energy. Wisdom and energy, they go together. Because to put effort in the spiritual path, to grow and mature in the spiritual path, we have to be wise to know where to put effort forth. And energy, right effort, in Buddhist teachings means to develop what is good and sustain what is good, to abandon what is bad and to not allow it to grow or arise again. So we're developing wholesome states of mind, wholesome speech and wholesome behavior, and sustaining that, making it grow, making it mature. And then wisely reflecting to avoid unskillful things, unwholesome behavior, unwholesome speech, and not allowing it to grow again. And this is wisdom, to discern virtue, to discern wholesomeness is wise. Wisdom is not some strange, brilliant light that will hit you on the head when you're sitting meditating. It is this ability to discern wholesome states and know, oh, this is a thought of kindness. And then, oh, I will develop this thought of kindness. This is goodness. This is virtue. This is patience. This is endurance. This is honesty. This is integrity. And to develop those, that's what wisdom means. And it also is to know, what is suffering? Am I suffering? And why am I suffering? What is the cause? So we start to dig down. And wisdom always leads to self-reliance. I spoke about this last week. The path of the Buddha is not to become dependent on anything else or anybody else, but to become more free, more self-reliant, self-dependent. That doesn't mean that there you come obsessed with yourself. What it means is that you come to know within yourself, why am I suffering? And where does that suffering come from? Because suffering arises because of attachment. Because we're clinging to something. We want something. We're demanding something. We're upset because we're missing out on something. Something has changed. Something has disappeared. And we don't agree with that. We don't want that to happen. Therefore, we resist. We struggle. Then we're in conflict. So wisdom is to know suffering and to abandon it. That is the path of becoming wiser and wiser. And as we abandon the cause of suffering, we abandon our desires, we abandon craving, we abandon clinging, then we find we're getting freer and freer. Because we have abandoned the causes of suffering. If we abandon the cause, then suffering cannot grow, cannot arise, and it will come to an end. So wisdom is applying the mind to discern what is a skillful way to lead one's life, to discern how to develop and grow. And if we start to cultivate these 10 barometers, particularly these first five that are described, then we're going to become more stable, more confident, more secure. We're going to have a sense of self-confidence, a sense of well-being, a sense of inner trust, a sense of security, because we're developing this emotional security, this emotional maturity, this stability of mind. And that's essential, because the untrained mind causes so much suffering. The reason we're unhappy is because we're thinking wrong, because the mind has not been trained properly. And if we just begin to train the mind steadily and progressively, then happiness grows and happiness matures, and those unskillful habits fall away. So this is a path for spiritual maturity, spiritual growth, the developing of the barometers. And these are actually essential. They lead to strength. They lead to inner well-being. And one other thing that I will say is that you can have two people in the world who are both intelligent, but one person has these barometers, sense of honesty, integrity, trustworthiness, reliability. And you know, who would we choose to be? Who would we choose to live with? Who would we choose to be with? The person who's just intelligent with information and ideas, or the person who has these barometers? So I will end the talk tonight, having talked about the 10 barometers, particularly the first five. And if you want to hear about the other five, then you can come next week or next time round. We're going to make the announcements, but one of the announcements which I may as well make myself is that on New Year's Eve, every year, the abbot of our monastery, Ajahn Brahmawangsu, has a party. He never invites me, but I've heard about this party for many years. And as he's gone on retreat, I've decided that I'll be involved this time round. And this party is a very Buddhist party, that it's a lot of people sitting very still, very calmly, but there's a lot of happiness there, and a lot of goodwill. And so the reason we hold this party each year on New Year's Eve is to see out the old year doing something skillful and good, and bring in the new year, because good luck is self-created. In Buddhism, we call it good karma. It's not good luck. It doesn't come out of the ether. It comes out of our actions. So to begin and make the new year fortuitous and prosperous for us, we begin by doing something very good. And on New Year's Eve, we'll begin about 9 o'clock here. There will be some auspicious chanting by the monks, and we'll sit some meditation, maybe listen to a Dhamma talk. And then around 11:20, I thought to do some chanting, which I will hand out some sheets to everybody who comes. And we're going to do the chanting of the recollection of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, both in the traditional Pali language, but we'll also do it in English, the translation. And we're going to do it in Pali 19 times, and then in English 18 times. And that makes 37, if I'm correct. And that is the 37 wings of awakening, the wings, those things that lead to enlightenment. And if you want to know what those 37 things are, you have to come on New Year's Eve. So that chanting is going to take about an hour, approximately, maybe a bit less. And it's something that everyone can take part in. It's very easy to learn. So if you wish to come along and join our New Year's Eve party, you're most welcome. And many benefits, because you don't have to fear about getting picked up by the booze bus on the way home. And also you spend some time with some very nice people.